From KUAZ Radio in Tucson, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up on today's show, Kimberly Kraft will tell you more about tuition tax credits, your chance to tell the Arizona government where at least some of your tax dollars should go. We'll get a guest commentary from former Arizona Congressman Jim Colby. Claudine LaMonaco talks with Tucsonan Kathy Padilla about her work building a home for orphans in the Central African nation of Zambia. We'll learn about the annual Christmastime bird count in Tucson when Robert Rappaport talks with Larry Leese, who's compiling that information. And meet a local group, Global Chant, who this weekend are hosting a Tucson show of sacred relics from Tibet. I'll talk with Dr. Victor Shamas. That's all coming up next here on Arizona Spotlight. It isn't often that you get the chance to tell the government what to do with your tax dollars, but next we'll hear about a way that you can prepay your tax obligation and direct that money to benefit the school of your choice. Kimberly Kraft reports.
Every once in a while, someone shows up at Miller's school to swipe a piece of the play structure. Not that they want to add to a collection, but because the district has determined that the thing has become antique and unsound. But try telling Armando Valenzuela that his school lacks anything at all, and he'll explain the platform of his successful candidacy for vice president of the student council.
Well, I wanted to be a role model to my little brothers. I mean, I want them to be up here like how I am doing it right now. We're a performing plus school. We plan to be the best in Tucson.
Miller has achieved that status in spite of severe overcrowding and limited resources. Built for 400, the school now educates more than 700 students, so many that open house is a three-night affair. That doesn't stop students from grasping the big picture.
I'm trying to make it bully-free and no one gets hurt, and to make all of the basket courts better.
The picture for Manny Vargas includes new playground equipment and staffing to support after-school clubs like basketball, art classes, and gardening. First-year principal Mary Anderson says kids want a tighter connection to their neighborhood, and she's looking to the state's tuition tax credit system to satisfy their yearning.
They'd like to be able to spend more time here in the afternoons, and in with that, we could use extra tax credit dollars to pay for chess coaches or teachers that would like to teach chess or gardening or art, technology, drama, any of the extracurricular type activities that would help the students build more community here.
In 1997, the Arizona legislature passed a measure that allows citizens to prepay their tax obligation to schools. An individual may donate up to $200, and a couple filing jointly may give $400 to fund extracurricular activities at the public school of their choice. That amount may be deducted from the donor's tax bill if that donation is received before December 31st. While Miller manages to supply the basics, what seem like simple wishes have disappeared with the advent of accountability, state standards, and testing. Anderson says extracurricular activities help build the relationships critical to academic success. She says students still talk about the artist in residence at Miller last year who taught them African drumming.
It's so important because that's where some of the students really excel, might be in art or in athletics, and without giving that opportunity to them, they may not feel successful in school. So having something right on campus, providing them the opportunity to participate in something that they excel in or something that they are passionate about is just fabulous for the students. And
like many schools on Tucson's south side, families have a lot of bang but not very much buck. Unlike parents in affluent neighborhoods, these families aren't as likely to scrape together the money to make a donation to their schools by year's end. Schools in upscale neighborhoods receive Midas-like riches in comparison, creating an inequity that State Representative Mark Anderson calls an unintended consequence of the legislation he sponsored.
I would have hoped that by now there could have been some effort made to create a fund that could help the lower income districts, that anybody in the state could donate to, sort of a general fund, and then that could be then distributed to the lower income ones that don't generate as much revenue. So that would kind of equalize it, but that hasn't happened.
And very likely that day won't come anytime soon, given widespread opposition to a system perceived as a compensation to school vouchers. Anderson doubts there is a legislative solution to making the tuition tax credit issue more equitable.
It's difficult to tweak it because you have some legislators who really support it and others who really don't like it. And so it's hard to come up with something that in a fairly closely divided legislature can get enough support from both sides to make a change.
Short of concrete change, Anderson, the principal, spends a part of her time convincing single or childless individuals to consider donating to Miller. Others, like TUSD Board President Joel Ireland, make formal pleas to his fellow lawyers to direct their donations to deserving schools. And others make appeals to their faith communities. Anderson, the lawmaker, remains optimistic about the status of Arizona schools, insisting that we are not in the basement in national rankings. Still, the looming budget deficit makes education financing an even greater challenge.
We're looking at $600 million because of revenues didn't come in as projected. And so in education, one of our big issues is funding. And if we could have $600 million in new funding for education, you know, there could be a lot of new initiatives and things that we could try.
To find a convincing argument for extracurricular citizen support, look no farther than Adrian Campoy, who in his first year at Miller ran a successful campaign for student body president.
Miller is the best school here in Tucson, actually the world, that we need money to help out the students and teachers for the students.
To make a tuition tax credit donation, simply drop it off at the school of your choice, put it in the mail, or do it electronically at the school district's website. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Kimberly Kraft.
In 1994, the United States signed a treaty called the North American Free Trade Agreement, which contains a provision allowing Mexican truckers access to U.S. highways. This cross-border program faces strong opposition from the Teamsters Union, and some in the U.S. Congress want to repeal that provision. In this guest commentary for Arizona Spotlight, former Congressman Jim Colby says that repealing the provision would be a mistake.
More than a decade ago, the United States, Mexico, and Canada entered into an agreement known as NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, a far-reaching trade compact that has opened up markets and benefited workers, producers, and consumers in all three countries. One of the provisions of the NAFTA agreement requires each country to open its borders to trucks from the others. A logical step, given the need to move products in a free trade environment. It is not a radical proposal. Trucks from Canada have readily moved across the border for decades and vice versa. Perhaps more surprising, the same was true of trucks from Mexico, at least until the 1980s, when because our trucks lacked equal treatment in that country, restrictions on movements of Mexican trucks were imposed. Everyone agrees that safety has to be the first priority. We don't want trucks on our highways that could be instruments of death or drivers who don't follow requirements for proper rest. But just as we inspect U.S. trucks and the logs of U.S. drivers periodically to make sure they are complying with all the rules and regulations, we can and we must do the same for trucks from Canada and Mexico when they cross our borders. That is what the United States Department of Transportation has proposed doing so that we can meet our NAFTA obligations. Conduct a full inspection to make sure that the truck, the driver, and all documents comply with our requirements. In fact, there would be even more rigorous inspection for trucks from Mexico because each truck, each driver, and each set of documents would be inspected every time it crosses the border. Trucks from our own country get inspected only very occasionally. Now, all the procedural and legal hurdles have been cleared away, and the Secretary of Transportation has begun a limited pilot program to be sure the system works as planned. Secretary Peters has appointed three people to serve as an independent monitoring group. I'm privileged to be a part of that team. Our job is to make sure inspections are being conducted properly and the data is collected and analyzed, which can assure us of compliance. All of us are committed to doing a thorough job. We have our own small staff to follow the process and analyze the data. It is up to the Secretary to decide if the results of the pilot program warrant going forward and allow all Mexican trucks that comply with safety standards to bring goods into the United States. But as an independent monitoring team, we are committed to letting the chips fall where they may. If Mexican trucks are not safe or cannot operate safely on our highways, they don't belong here, and we will say so. But if the opposite is true, if trucks and drivers from Mexico don't have a worse safety record, then it is time for the United States to live up to its obligations under the NAFTA agreement. To do otherwise invites retaliation from Mexico that could damage our exports and cause a loss of jobs. More important, it would send the wrong signal to our neighbors and other potential trading partners that the United States can't be counted on to live up to its promises. All trucks traveling our roads and highways should be safe. But as long as they are, we shouldn't be concerned whether the license plate is from Missouri, Manitoba, or Mexico.
Jim Colby is the chairman of the Canamex Trade Corridor Task Force. The corridor runs from Mexico City through Tucson and north to Edmonton, Alberta. The November issue of Smithsonian Magazine features photos taken by children who live in an orphanage in the Central African Republic of Zambia. The orphanage was started by a Tucsonan, Kathy Padilla, who will tell us more about her work in this interview with Claudine LaMonaco.
Zambia has one of the highest HIV infection rates in the world. Recent statistics estimate that up to 37% of the country's 11 million people are infected. The disease has left up to 2 million children orphaned. In 1999, longtime Tucson activist Kathy Padilla, who helped found the Tucson Community Food Bank, started an orphanage to help children in Zambia. She now lives there 6 months out of the year. The program houses 50 children and educates another 100 in what is considered to be one of the best schools in the country. I asked Padilla how she learned about Zambia and got involved.
July 4th, 1999, there was a large newspaper article in the Arizona Daily Star about the homeless orphan children living on the streets of Lusaka, Zambia. And what really struck me was a photograph of a little child with food in her lap. And the caption read, "These are some of the 100 children being fed every day at the Fountain of Hope, an organization that has 2,000 children registered." And I was so horrified by the thought of, how do you decide which 100 children get to eat that day? That I put down the newspaper and said to myself, I can figure out how to feed 100 or 200 children a day, even as far away as Lusaka. And so I set about figuring out how to do that.
I was stunned to learn that 80% of Zambian families have taken in orphans.
And that's just an estimate from in the 90s. Possibly it's higher. I know many, many people who have simply taken children off the street that they'd never met before. There's no such word as orphan in most traditional languages in Zambia. Families have always taken in children, and they continue to do so. The reason there are children living on the streets, though, is because there are now so many children. There, I personally know grandmothers who have 20 and 30 orphaned grandchildren they're trying to raise. When that grandmother dies, those children have no one.
What are the goals of the program?
We make three commitments to these children when we take them in. We will give every child as much education as we possibly can. It, of course, depends on how old they are when they come to us and whether or not they've ever been to school before and that sort of thing. We promise to train every child in a skill so that when they do, you know, when they're adults or they've finished as much education as they can, they will have a good skill with which to work or barter. And we teach every child sustainable farming methods. We have a very, very large garden, and we literally get bushels of produce a day from our garden. And so, again, we're teaching our children how to survive with what a traditional small plot in Zambia, but be able to use that small plot for years and years to just keep turning over the soil and putting more nutrients into it. And so that is our commitment to those children, so that when they become adults, they will be able to, you know, have families of their own and be able to sustain themselves.
Can you tell me about some of the students or orphans that are at the school?
I'd be happy to. One of the children dearest to my heart is Daniel, who was brought to us in July of 2001. The police found him living by himself on the streets. He was 2 years old and extremely malnourished. Those first 2 weeks, this little boy could do nothing much more than just lay all day. But after a couple of weeks of having 3 meals a day, he started perking up and, you know, within a month he was acting like a normal 2-year-old, you know, running around and getting into things. But for many years after that, actually until this year, Daniel actually believed that I was in fact his own grandmother. And so we had a very close bond because I was Daniel's Ambuya. And
well, how is he doing now? How old is he now?
He's now 7. He's in the second grade. He's doing very well. Just a very happy, healthy, normal little boy.
How do you find the kids?
They're not hard to find. Uh-huh. They're referred by either a church or someone on our board in Zambia or someone that we know and trust that's working with children. The hardest part is having to turn the children away. And I know it's a death sentence that they're being brought to us because this family is absolutely desperate. And when we have to say no, it's very, very difficult.
How much does it cost to do this, and where do you get the money for it?
Well, we have one major donor from Canada. The Glasgow Foundation is helping us build the buildings. But I spend all of my time here in the U.S. raising funds. This year, I think our budget is about $350,000. I get checks for $2 and $3 some months from people on Social Security. But luckily, I also get checks for $1,000. I have lived in Tucson all my life, and I really am convinced that I couldn't have made this happen if I did not live in Tucson. Tucson is one of the most generous cities, literally, in the U.S. And those first 4 or 5 years, almost 100% of the funding came from Tucson. And that's how I managed to slowly build this.
Thank you so much for coming in today and speaking with us.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
For more information about the Zambian Children's Fund, you can find the link at KUAZ.org. as well as a link to a gallery of the photographs taken by the children in Zambia. Those links again are online at kuaz.org. Birders will gather in Tucson this weekend to make an effort at taking an accurate count of the local bird population within a large circle radiating out from Oracle and River Roads. Next, Robert Rappaport talks with the man who's leading the effort.
Larry Lease, volunteer compiler for the Tucson Valley Christmas Bird Count. Welcome to Arizona Spotlight.
Thank you.
What is the purpose of the annual bird count?
Well, it's a long-running count that's been going on since 1900, where volunteers get out there and count the birds. It's in the Christmas season at each individual count, and they're spread all the way across the country. And it's recreation. It's fun. But it edges towards a little bit of citizen science for people. They can go an extra step instead of just going out and birding for fun. What they see, actually, the data can be used by researchers to look for long-term trends in bird species populations. So it's kind of fun to do a little extra.
And how do you go about counting the birds? Do you just look up in the sky and go 1, 2, or you have a more scientific method of doing this?
Well, each of these Christmas bird count circles is 15 miles in diameter, and it's a set point. The center of the circle is picked, and maps get made by various people, and people get assigned to a certain section of the circle without overlap, and they get to count during that day, the count day, which ours for the Tucson Valley count is on Sunday, the 16th, and they get assigned to a certain area, and they go out there. Probably, usually it's a team of 2 or 3 or 4 people for a given section, and they'll pick the best spot first for the early morning when the birds are active. And then they'll count up all the birds they see, keeping track of both species and the numbers they see.
So these volunteers know how to recognize, obviously, one bird from the other.
Well, we don't want them to guess. But what I try to do as the compiler is the goal is kind of to have each group have a seasoned birder in there. But there are other tasks, such as keeping track of the results, writing all this down, and just spotting birds, saying, hey, there's a bird over here that I don't think we've seen yet. Then the seasoned birder will be the guy who makes the positive ID. They have, sometimes you can ID the bird down to a group, and they do have spots to put that on the data forms. which is slightly less useful but does have some value. But we don't want people to guess.
Now, if somebody sees one bird or two birds, does one bird equal X number of other birds, or is that considered one bird? Or do you
everything
assume
is one? You keep track of all birds. You don't want to double count. And here's where the compiler at the end of the day, say there's a rare hawk that's soaring over one area. It could be seen by more than one group. So the compiler does have a responsibility to say, hey, if we saw some really rare hawk, we've got to try to figure out what time of day it was maybe and try to figure out whether there was a single individual or perhaps two.
Now, how scientific is this count?
It's a good question. It is recreation leaning towards citizen science. So it's less scientific than what true researchers are doing just for research purposes. But the value of the long-term trends, there's no other data set that is this long. This is since 1900. So when bird populations change as a result of development, even climate change, we have this really long picture of what used to be where for bird species.
And what have your trends over the past 100 years shown you? Different species arriving and leaving, or are the numbers up or down?
That has occurred. I don't have a good handy-dandy interesting example to throw out there. But, as certain species have declined, it will show up. And certain species, there's one called a loggerhead shrike. It's what we hear in the birding world is that it's not declining in our area, but other areas it's declining sharply. To rather large percentages, it's dropped by a rather large percentage.
Is there a way to ascertain whether development was a problem and made the birds disappear?
Is that just habitat conjecture? Loss is always stated to be the number one cause of problems with birds.
And if our listeners want to get involved with this bird count, what can they do at this point?
There's a second level of participation, which is feeder watchers, where you watch your backyard and just area right around your house and send those results in, and we do include that in its own special category. And I would encourage people to get involved in that way at this stage of the game for our count. The really nice thing about birding is that you can enjoy birding at all levels, from just looking at your feeder in your backyard, and you'll see a bright red male cardinal. And it's like, holy cow, look how pretty that is. And it's pretty visual to start with. And then as you get used to your backyard birds, you might get a field guide, which shows you all the birds generally in the U.S. and Canada. And it'll show you those, and you can figure out what birds they are. But then as you go out, say, on an Audubon field trip, you'll start seeing more and more different birds that you don't get in your backyard.
Larry Lease, volunteer compiler for the Tucson Valley Christmas Bird Count. Thank you for joining us on Arizona Spotlight.
You're welcome.
I'm Robert Rappaport.
If you'd like to take part in the Tucson Valley Bird Count, you can get more information online at KUAZ.org. Every Wednesday, there's a group of people who come together on the campus of the University of Arizona for a special purpose. They are women and men, young and old, from diverse backgrounds, and they meet to share a time and a place and the intention of making positive change in the world, starting with chant. I spent an evening sharing in the experience and talking with Global Chant's originator, psychologist and author Dr. Victor Shamas. I've traveled just a few blocks away from the studios of KUAZ here to the Little Chapel. Tell me something about the group that meets here on Wednesdays.
The group is called Global Chant. It's been meeting for nearly 12 years, about a decade in this one spot. Global Chant basically embraces chanting from different traditions around the world, Sufi, Hindu, Christian, Buddhist, Native American, etc. And our circle is also a healing circle. It's not just about chanting. We set intention. We have a healing basket where we put the names of people for whom we're dedicating our chanting. And we've been doing this for a long time, and a lot of members of the community have taken part in it.
How did you first become interested in the world of chant?
Well, I have to date it back to the time I was 3 years old, and I heard Mahalia Jackson singing gospel. She used to come on the TV and sing for 5 minutes every weekday. And the first time I heard Mahalia sing gospel, it was an absolute life-changing experience at the age of 3. And since then, I've been involved in making sacred music in one form or another my entire life.
What do you think exactly are the fundamental principles that would link a Sufi or Tibetan chant to gospel sung by Mahalia Jackson?
I think the link has to do with the intention and the spirit with which it comes. Chanting really is a device to get you out of your mind and into someplace bigger than that, a place of connection with all things in this universe. And I don't care if you're singing gospel or Sufi chants or Hindu bhajans, you're looking for that experience, you're looking for that connection.
In addition to using all these techniques that are based in ancient tradition, tell me about something that you've been doing that's based on modern tradition.
Well, this year we started a website that's called Act on Wisdom. And the idea is to bring together healers and healing circles of different types from every corner of the world and create a networking entity for those circles. The prophecy in the lineage in which I was trained has said that some of this wisdom has been underground for 500 years. And the time is right for this wisdom, this healing wisdom, that's very basic and very simple, to come back up out of the ground and out of the ashes. And the internet is a wonderful, wonderful medium for doing that.
Do you view chanting as a means unto itself, or do you see it as part of a larger program of living your life?
The teacher I worked with taught us that the chanting was one of many vehicles for healing. And he also taught us that all healing is self-healing. What we do is we start by creating that sense of wholeness and balance within ourselves. And that's infectious. That's as infectious or perhaps more so than any disease. And so we can't necessarily heal somebody, but by healing ourselves, we can transfer that experience of healing and that process to others. And really, that's what we do in the circle. You know, you never know if when you send blessings and love and healing energy to someone else, whether or not they receive it. But it's to your benefit to do it. It brings us into balance. So chanting is part of an entire way of life that includes certain basic values that all spiritual peoples have had throughout the ages, regardless of what they believe. This isn't about belief, it's about action. It's about having action that's based on basic values like compassion, humility, forgiveness, serenity, detachment, selfless service, unconditional love. Those are the basic values the chanters embrace, and that's what we try to practice here in this group every Wednesday night.
This weekend, Victor Shamas and Global Chant will welcome an exhibit of holy relics from Tibet. These are crystalline formations left behind by enlightened Buddhist masters. These relics are on a tour of just 100 cities around the world. In Tucson, the relics will be on display for one weekend only at Anjali Yoga Studio at 330 East 7th Street. There is an opening tonight starting at 7 p.m., and regular viewing hours are tomorrow and Sunday from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. The Heart Shrine Relic Tour is open to the public. We have links online at KUAZ.org to more information on the event, along with a way to contact the group Global Chant. That's all at KUAZ.org. That's Arizona Spotlight for this week. As always, thank you for listening. Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio from the University of Arizona and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. Most of the music heard on our program, including the theme, was written and performed by Calexico. I'm Mark McLemore.